Hello, welcome to the Enduro World Series podcast. My name is Rick McLaughlin, and last week I thought we had a lot to cram into the show, but this week apparently there is even more to get through. So let's quickly catch up with my good friend and colleague, a man who has Scottish borders, barbers sharpening their shears in anticipation. It is Mr. Rory Cunningham. Rory, how's it hanging?
I mean, if we're talking about the hair, it's long and low. I mean, how am I going to make it to April, mate?
You've sort of transitioned into a Keanu Reeves in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure sort of look going on.
I mean, to the listeners, be thankful that there's not a video feed yet, because, I mean, I don't know what you make of it, Rick, but, I mean, it's awful. It's been my coffee this morning, it's been my orange juice. I mean, I would have been riding, but I don't think the helmet would go over the top of it. I reckon I'll have to call up Giro and go, hi Giro, can you send me an XL helmet between now and April, and then I'll have mediums after that. I mean,
you can't go outside, mate. The pigeons will get you, the amount of stuff that's in that hair, right? I've obviously seen the analytics of this podcast, and I know that people are tuning in from all over the world, so to hear our garbled attempts at the English language. But worth mentioning that spring is actually trying to spring in Scotland at the minute. We've talked a bit about the snow in the past, but it's actually quite nice outside at the minute.
Yeah, and it certainly felt a little bit more like spring in the last week, considering it felt like the Arctic the week before that. But I think... there's a sense of optimism in the air that we might actually get some riding in soon, so yeah. Looking forward to it.
Definitely, definitely, and that's sort of hopefully fuel a bit like optimism with some talk about mountain bike racing, right? On the news, we are amidst perhaps what is one of the biggest and most important times of the year for us here at the Enduro World Series, and that is the week and a bit or so when entries go live to the public, and we broke our own records with the demand for spots last year. We've increased the spaces this year to 7,000, and demand. I think we talked about this before. I think once outdoor events and sport gets back underway this year, everyone's had enough lockdown, everyone's had enough Zoom calls, it's time to go racing. If you want to get involved, check out EnduroWorldSeries.com. We're putting a different EWS round up most evenings now, 8 o'clock GMT. Take a look online, find out what you want, which one you want to enter. Have maybe a backup as well is always a good plan. And hopefully we'll see you at the races later in the summer. What was the first bike race you entered, Rory? Was it that one you won in Fort William?
I wish. first bike race I won. It was actually up your neck of the woods. It was is it Canoel Hill in Perth? I knew it as something called Dookie Woods, but the Clan, which was an old Scottish team, put on a race. I think they call it the Mad March race, and I was 12 or 13, gave it a crack, came third, never looked back since. What about yourself?
Mine was a bit later than that. Lifetime-wise, I did a 24-hour XC race with a mate of mine I used to work with down in the southwest of England, down a place called Blagden. We didn't realise that if you do a 24-hour race as a pair, that you don't actually see anybody for 24 hours because never one of you comes in, the other one goes out. Had a few too many beers the night before it, and it was pretty disastrous, if I'm honest. It wasn't really like... I didn't come out of it thinking this is my calling, this is something I should do for the rest of my life, but... not as much fun, definitely, as an EWSE or an EWS would be. Get on to EnduroWorldSeries.com if you fancy getting between the tapes this summer, and hopefully you can witness Rory's hair for yourself. Now, if you were going to race one this year, just out of interest, I'm not trying to say that you're about to be made redundant, but if you had a bit more time in your hands this summer, which one would you go for? Tweed Valley would have to be, wouldn't it? You wouldn't have to get the van out of the drive.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I'm just right from the door to practice. But, that's a tough one. I mean, I think if you look at the first two Italian events, you know, Val di Fassa and Le Twil, double events, you know, if you can get as an EWS racer, certainly, I'd still consider myself in that bracket, you know, a double event, two races in a week. I mean, the amount of time you get on the bike would just be amazing. And those two venues, you know, big alpine stages, and really what enduro is all about. So one of those two, I think, if I was entering an EWS, and if I was entering an EWSC, it's hard to look past the recent change to Finale, you know, 2-day e-bike race. Some incredible statistics that I think we spoke about last time, being thrown around to as to how many meters descending that race might involve. So I think I'd definitely be going to Italy, to one of those three venues.
I think Italy's hard to look past, isn't it, just in terms of, like, if you're gonna go anywhere for a holiday, it's gotta have, you know, fantastic trails, good food, good drink, good coffee, and Italy just does that with ease, doesn't it? It's effortless for it. But I mean, we're obviously a bit biased, but the EWS has always done this really well, and that you look at that calendar and there isn't really a round that you're not excited to go to. Do you know what I mean? It's pretty stacked. I think if it was me, if you're talking about, yeah, you're talking about that corner of the world, Pietra Ligure, Finale Ligure, there's so much you can do in terms of building a riding holiday off the back of going to the race as well. Do you know what I mean? You get an extra 4 or 5 days there on the bike. To be honest, Tweed Valley is the same as well. There's a lot you could do around there if you've not been to that part of the world before. I think there's definitely a strong case to be made for all of them, right? More exciting news in that we have more racing to update you on. We're down under again this week for the Intense Cycles Capital Kamikaze at Mount Stromlo. Very famous Australian race venue. Georgina von Marburg took the win ahead of Casey Voisey in the elite women's race, whilst the men's race was won by Canyon's Kaya Hearn. Big talent there from the world of UCI World Cup downhill racing. He beat Tim Eaton home by 6 seconds. Pretty stacked field. Josh Button also in the mix. Rory, Mount Stromlo, close racing. How much advantage do the Southern Hemisphere riders travelling northwards for the racing have, given that they've had a chance to get their eye in, haven't they, while we're still trying to dig the shed out of the snow?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, we see a lot of, in different times, we'd see a lot of European riders heading to sunnier climates this time of year. I think it's difficult to say. I think there's definitely a kind of hard, gritty kind of way that the Brits get through the winter, which I think puts them in good stead for the season when things get tough. You've just been through a whole winter riding in the sleet and snow.
With cornflakes in your hair.
What's that?
It's all right. It's a podcast. They can't see it. They can't see it.
I've got my hat off today and I'm trying to be at peace with it, but it's just, I mean, I'm sick of it. But I think, isn't it an advantage? Possibly. It's quite interesting. Last year, I thought certainly some of the success that British riders had having a whole summer to train effectively rather than coming straight out of the winter. But I think the riders from down under have always gone better in dry conditions, but then you look at like Sam Hill, who probably never seen rain in his life, and some of his most famous race runs are when there's a river running down the track. So, maybe a little bit nicer not having to wash your kit after every single ride. But when it comes to the season, you've got to be prepared for anything.
Yeah, EWS qualifiers starting to spring into life now all over the place. So we'll keep you updated on those as we head rapidly towards the race season getting underway later in the year. Now, we've got more team news to talk to you about as well. Also in the news this week, Giant Factory Off-Road Enduro Team have reconfirmed their lineup with Ewan Deneau, McKay Vezina. Ewan was basically their sole rider last season due to the travel restrictions. 8th at Vittoria EWS Pietra Ligure, 13th at Bluegrass EWS Finale Ligure. A former Rookie of the Year, bit of a silent assassin. Rory, what do you make of Deneau?
Yeah, I think you've summed it up perfectly with silent assassin. A man of few words, but certainly lets his riding do the talking. I was out on the stages in Pietra, and he was visibly one of the fastest riders coming through every time I saw him. So very, very talented. I think under the radar a little bit, to be honest. In 2019, obviously 2018 Rookie of the Year, had some really standout results, but I think he had a couple of top five finishes as a privateer. 2019, signed with Giant, had a few injuries and just never really found that form again. And then last year, we definitely caught glimpses of the speed that he showed in a couple of years previous. So definitely one to watch in my eyes. I think he could surprise a few people this year, maybe even grace a podium. Very, very highly rated.
I think as well, he's a racer, Ewan, who... he's one of those really gifted few that it doesn't really matter what the stages are doing or what the conditions are doing. He's just fast. Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of ingrained in him. I remember we went to North Star in California back in 2019, and it was one of the first times we had a shakedown stage. And the team there selected this sort of bike park trail to give the media and the fans a sort of closer glimpse of the riders. And Josh Carlson, who we'll speak about in a second, was blown away riding behind Ewan because he was just sending all these huge gaps and the sort of bike park riding that he hadn't had a chance to do with him. And he said, like, no matter what it is, he just can turn it on when it counts. So, yeah, excited to see what he can do this season. Josh Carlson, for offer himself, long-time staple of that Giant squad. Going to be racing EWSE events this year. Already a national champ in Australia on the e-bike. Do you think... I kind of think with Josh as well, he's a big, strong dude. And if anybody's going to muscle an e-bike around, it'll be him.
Yeah, Josh Carlson, great guy. Let's not forget, he's been on EWS podium before as well in Whistler. This is a tricky one. I think he would have liked to have go over to Europe and done the EWSC races we had last year, understand what they're about. It'll be interesting to see how he makes that transition. Obviously, like you say, the Australian e-bike national champ already, but it'll be really interesting. I think a man of Josh's talent's not gonna struggle for long. He'll figure it out. And certainly a good transition for him, and I think we'll see him right up there and on the podium at a few EWSC races this year.
Just a bit of housekeeping for regular listeners as well. We are hopefully in the next couple of episodes going to be getting guests on here as well, once I've worked out how to get the sort of the hole in the bottom of the soup can and the string attached to it, and like get someone else on the other end of it. But one of the people we do need to book in is Josh Carlson, because he's just, I mean, you just come away just buzzing for bike racing, just chatting to him. He also does a really good little YouTube series. I think it's called The Spoken Trail, where he does a bit of a GoPro talky course preview sort of style, runs of trails. Really entertaining and really worth looking out. Right. Big one next. Orange are back. Orange Factory Racing going to be fielding an EWS squad with Lachlan Blair, Joe Connell and Tom Wilson aboard there. Rory, plenty of pedigree with Orange, isn't there? And you're probably one of the few UK pros not to have ridden for them at some stage.
Yeah, I probably am, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, and great to see Orange back, you know, tried and trusted technology and some really talented young guys with Lachlan, Joe and Tom. So great to see them have a presence at the races again. And you know, the bikes haven't changed a huge amount over the years, but to be perfectly honest, Orange were one of the first that really pushed the kind of current enduro bike and trail bike geometry. And we're talking, I mean, probably 8 to 10 years ago, they were the ones that were starting to, you know, put 64 degree head angles on 140mm travel bikes. So although the frames don't look like they've changed much, you know, they keep up with the times when it comes to the numbers and the kind of geometry. So it'll be interesting to see what those guys do. And I saw the other day they also have an e-bike. So it'll be interesting to see if they grace the EWSE with that this year as well. So great to see them back.
Yeah, I think you can actually even go back further. I remember getting copies of Mountain Biking UK magazine, like in the mid to late 90s, whenever they brought out the Patriot. Remember they brought it out and it was all silver, and that was sort of, it was a long travel trail bike before there was any kind of like scene around that kind of machinery. I don't know, there's certain superlatives that get chucked around the bike industry quite lazily these days. I think iconic is one of them, but I mean, Steve Peat on an Orange was the 222 and the 223s back in the day. It's definitely apt, iconic. There's no arguing with it. Yeah, you're right. The bikes have a similar silhouette. I think the technology, rear shock technology, really came to them with that single pivot design and sort of helped out no end. They used to do a really nice little line in short travel full suspension bikes. There was the bikes like the ST4, they did a Stage 4 that I tested for a magazine once, that they've always had a good finger on the pulse of UK riding. So yeah, looking forward to seeing that brand back in amongst the sharp end of it. Lachlan Blair as well, he had a good run in, where was it, Finale last season?
Yeah, I think he was maybe it was Pietro. I'm sure he was knocking around the top 10 at the kind of halfway point in the race. So yeah, Lachlan kind of real strong guy. You can kind of, being the Highlander, you can kind of picture him tossing cables around in the off season and pedaling uphill through knee deep mud. I think that's why they all get strong. But he certainly showed some speed last year. And yeah, hopefully this year we'll see him step up again, and maybe he can continue that through entire races, and we'll see him right up there.
Right, looking forward to catching up with those guys at the races then. Also, the Sun French Connection Racing outfit has been announced. That's a new look squad, actually, which is kind of an evolution of the old Sun team, which used to have Kevin McHale, who's since departed. Theo Galli remains on there. He got that podium at Specialized EWS Zermatt in 2020. He's one of the best in the world for me when it comes to technical sort of steep rock riding. Given that he's from the area surrounding Olargue, probably no big surprise there. Your mate is on there too, Louis Jandal, someone that you gave a couple of shout-outs to over the last few episodes. Young French talent on a French team, that sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, not a huge amount of change there, I guess, other than big Kev's missing, so be interesting to see where he goes. But yeah, like you say, Theo Galli kind of had a bit of a breakout year last year, getting on his first podium. We all know that he's had the talent for years, certainly one of the most skilled riders, like you say, when it comes to the really technical stuff. And then Louis Jandal, I mentioned him, I think, on the podcast last time, but he looked very, very fast last year. Similar to Johan Denault, kind of went under the radar a little bit. I believe it was two top tens, maybe at Zermatt and Pietra, but certainly an exciting young French team there, and I'd expect to see those guys, you know, fighting for podiums this season as well.
Guillaume Larbeyu also on there. The depth of talent is just unreal in France. Larbeyu is actually from near Lourdes, so no shortage of good riding around those parts. I've been there a few times for downhill World Cups in the past. It's kind of like, I don't know, once we get Trophy of Nations back up and running again, whenever hopefully the pandemic situation eases, that Team France squad, the depth of strength there is just ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, you feel that the French could have an A, a B and a C team and probably get on the podium, all three of them. It's definitely the country that's churning out the talent. We've quite often have spoken about Antoine Vidal coming through. Obviously, you've got Isabeau, Morgan Schaar, Melanie Pujon, who won all three of the women's races last year, Adrian Daly, Florian Nicolai. I mean, you'd probably run out of fingers to count on trying to come up with podium contenders. It just seems to be like a talent factory. So I think it's testament to the riding that they have and the variation of riding that they have out there. But right now they're the nation to beat.
Mountain biking, it's funny like that, isn't it? It just seems to be in different disciplines, like some nations just take the ball and run with it. I mean, you look at downhill at the start of the century, it was all UK riders. Cross country at the minute, so much Swiss talent. Enduro, really the French are just so, so strong. And it's just kind of funny the way it works, isn't it?
Yeah, like I guess like we saw with downhill in the 90s, you know, France were just so, so strong. And then in maybe 10 years later, or kind of early 2000s, we saw this real kind of surge out of Australia with Sam Hill, Kavarik, Rennie. Then 5 years later, all the Brits, you know, G, Danny, Petey, Josh, Brendan. And then now we're kind of going back into this surge of French talent again. So it's really interesting. I think it kind of comes in waves. Right now, it seems to be France's time, and yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out, and you know, where the next kind of pool of talent comes from, and which country it'll be.
Well, speaking of French talent as well, one last bit of team news is that just breaking is that Peugeot have announced their EWSE team, and it includes Yannick Pontal, the winner of the first ever EWSE race last year. Big signing for them.
Yeah, big signing for them, big signing for Yannick as well. I think we all went into last year assuming that Nico Williams was going to be the favourite for the EWSE races, and yeah, straight out of the gate, Yannick put one on his teammate at the time, so he was running for Lapierre as well. So it's great to see him get the opportunity with Peugeot, kind of step away from Lapierre and be the lead rider on that team. So yeah, excited to see what he can do, and yeah, it should provide some good racing this year.
Yeah, I mean, brands don't get much more steeped in cycling pedigree than Peugeot, and as well, it's kind of cool to see. I mean, we've seen similar in the past with whenever Lars Vergier stepped away from the setup that Loic Bruni was on, and it's all great being really close friends and enjoying the racing and stuff, but at the end of the day, when there's work to do and there's races to be won, somebody's always going to come off second place, so maybe that's the decision that's been taken there. But yeah, no, I'm super excited to see how that works out for him, actually. One last little bit of news. Maxxis have just launched the latest evolution of their shorty tyre, and it's already won an EWS. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wasn't looking out for it.
It got past me, I'm not going to lie to you. It got past me.
But yeah, I think it was Jesse Melamed that won Zermatt in it with it, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it looks like, a fairly minimal update, but I guess less aggressive than the old one. The kind of side knobs seem to be a little bit more akin with a dry tire and sipes in them, which should provide better grip on hard surfaces like rocks or areas of hard pack. So yeah, kind of a small update, but yeah, definitely definitely a good way to launch the tyre. Yeah, we've got this new tyre, it's already won an EWS. So
yeah, it's great. I actually think it's great to see. You know, it's great to see products being developed the right way, you know, through racing. And if it's good enough for Jesse to ride at that pace in those conditions, then I think that speaks volumes to a consumer base. We need to do a podcast. I keep on thinking of things we need. I do actually have a list of this, but we need to do an episode at some stage just talking about tyres, because they're so key to enduro, and they're so, I mean, everyone has an opinion on tyres, and everyone has, you know, a go-to choice. The shorty, I've always loved the original one because it was the perfect Scotland between October to about April front tyre. Yeah, let's do one, and let's have a chat about tyres at a later date. Right, are you ready? I've got lined up here a bit of a deep philosophical question I want you to consider, Rory, and get your opinion on, because I know you're a man who's never short of opinions. But do you think, right, bear with me, we're gonna talk about a big one, and that is the ceiling. Have we reached, or are we getting very close to the tech ceiling for enduro race bikes now? I'm not talking about e-bikes here. I think that's a completely different topic for a completely different podcast. What I'm talking about is I'm kind of struggling to see where the next big leap in enduro bike technology is going to be, because the bikes are so good now. And it feels like there's lots of little revisions and sort of massaging of details and sort of little bits and pieces here and there. But, you know, you look at how good the bikes are now. I mean, you've got, you know, incredible suspension that offers actually very little weight penalty and performance over a day. Geometry that, if it gets much slacker, much longer, is actually going to become quite awkward to ride. Like brakes, like the Shimano XTR M9100s that we were running last year, you can do literally nine mile descents on those, and the actual like heat build up and lever feel is nearly negligible. Are we running out of places that these bikes can be made better, do you think? Sorry, I've just sort of bowled this at you out of the blue. Go on.
Yeah. Well, you started by saying, have we reached the ceiling? I can't see the ceiling because my fringe is in my eyes. But it's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, I think in some aspects, I don't know if we'll see bikes, when it comes to, say, geometry, I don't know if we'll see bikes have much more travel or be much slacker or longer. I'm sure we'll see adjustments there. But when it comes to the actual technology, it's something I think about quite a lot, to be honest. I think there are some areas for development. I think we'll begin to see more electric components on bikes. And I don't mean that in the sense of gears or seat posts. I think more in kind of like data acquisition. Certainly if you look at, for example, like e-bikes, I can see there being some sort of almost traction control that would come into that, like a way that the motor would monitor the output through the chain and kind of adjust the torque accordingly. You know, we're getting to see that in motocross bikes and obviously MotoGP bikes and things. There's always that question about gearboxes, how efficient are they, and can that be a thing? But
well, you see, I've got a theory about gearboxes. I did a bit of research into this for a column once, and I ran a gearbox bike for a couple of months. I don't know. I get the sort of crux of the problem that you've got an external transmission that's exposed to the elements. Like, I get that. But I don't think that a gearbox actually, it doesn't offer, well, the cost benefit. You tear a mech off and, you know, you can go to any bike shop and replace it relatively simply. The weight penalty of having a gearbox is fairly high. You've got to have a frame that accommodates it. They pedal in a very odd way, and you change gears in a very different way. And I just don't know if... I think there's something beautifully simple about how the gears, external regular gear system on a mountain bike works, and I don't know if a gearbox is actually that much of, like, that much of a benefit, really. I don't know, there's probably gearbox manufacturers listening to this throwing their car radios out the window, but...
Yeah, throwing their clipboards across the room. It's a difficult one. I think the big question, like, the pros of the gearbox are undoubtedly, like, it keeps things in one place. It's more compact. You can get the weight. I mean, the cassettes and mechs aren't exactly heavy these days, are they? It gets the weight lower down.
But modern shifting, the shifting performance now is so good. That's the thing, that the arguments like the gearbox one, it barrels on and barrels on and barrels on, but it does so by ignoring how far we've come with regular transmissions. Like, the stuff that comes on modern, this is kind of my point, is the stuff that comes on modern bikes now is so good that it's sort of hard to see where we jump to next.
I think with e-bikes, with the electric motor already being down low in the frame, and all the, you know, all the technology and all the moving parts associated with that, you feel that, like, certainly for me, I think if normal bikes, I'm not so sure because they don't have that extra weight. But you feel, could you somehow incorporate the gearbox into that, and then you just have a single chain to the rear.
So that really difficult thing that we've taken decades to try and get our heads around, you want to incorporate that with a new thing that's in the same place that's also very hard to get your head around?
Pretty much. I mean, you look at, I mean, if we're, you know, we see a lot of comparisons between e-bikes and motorbikes or motocross and enduro bikes. You know, we're seeing brands like Husqvarna, Yamaha, like we're seeing these motorcycle brands coming in. You've got to think that, you know, if you think about the way that a motocross bike works, and there's electric motocross bikes now, and they've not got a cassette and a mech. So is there a way of, you know what I mean?
That's true. Making it
more compact and in one unit like we're seeing on them. I think there's got to be. And with the motor assist that you get on an e-bike, there's obviously a small amount of drag from the motor anyway. I think drag of a gearbox, just with how compact it would be on a regular bike when you've not got that motor assist, would be much more noticeable. But if you kind of added that to the already electric motor with that assist, I think it would kind of make it pretty negligible, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting. And one of the big things I would say about the gearbox bike I spent a lot of time with was that the back end of it worked like nothing else I've ever ridden. Do you know what I mean? It basically, it's quite, I don't know, it's maybe simplifying it a bit, but it felt like it had a fork on the back of it as opposed to the traditional shock and sort of chain feedback. And it was... Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. No, I can see that aspect of it, but I also just think it's a massive workaround for some problems that maybe aren't just as prevalent as they once were. You can also, I mean, you're talking about motorbikes, you can see similar parallels with the car industry in that more and more effort is going into throwing sort of tech at them and tech integration and screens and turn them into basically an extension of your smartphone. Mountain biking, we've got things like Bluetooth dropper posts and Bluetooth shifting. Do you think that's an advantage when it comes to enduro racing? Is that where we're going to go?
Yeah, I can definitely see that sort of thing. I think we've seen in recent years, we've seen some riders making like on the fly kind of adjustments. You know, like coming to a pedally section at a race and then like reaching and twisting something on their fork to kind of load a bunch of high speed compression onto it, so it keeps it really rigid and high in the travel. I can genuinely see like people, you know, if we think about motocross bikes that you've got a if you've ridden one, a relatively recent one, they have quite often have like a three position button on the handlebar that's like map one, map two, map three, and like map one is like your mellow power band and kind of smoother power delivery, and map three is like rip your arms off. And I can see that transitioning into mountain bikes and enduro bikes, but through the suspension, not the motor. So for example, a good example of this would be Zermatt this year. We had, I think it was the second stage, top section was quite fast, rocky, rough, and then for the last 2 minutes, it went on to like a really kind of smooth, almost trail kind of, what you say, like trail center kind of style stage. Smooth, pretty flat, fast rolling, and certainly not something where you'd want a 180mm travel bike with shorties, even though it didn't show slow Jesse down.
Didn't slow Jesse down.
If you had a button on your handlebar where you got to that stage and that section of the stage, you could push it, and suddenly the compression, say the compression in your fork and shock both like changed to give you more support to make the bike have more of a platform to hold you higher in the travel, so you're not wallowing about like you might be on a, or like you might want it on another section. I mean, I think there's got to be ways of doing that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't want to like, I know inside your wee head at the minute you're thinking that you could be onto £1 million idea here, but didn't Lapierre trial something like that? Lapierre had a bike that did that about 10 years or so ago, which basically there was an accelerometer in the fork which told the shock what was coming. If that makes sense, like that's, again, a very simplified version of it, but certainly really interesting. But I think I love the fact about mountain bikes is that they're really an object of compromise, and it's all a balance. And I just wanted to get your take off. Do you think if you put more technology on them, does more technology open the door for more mechanical issues?
I think even though we're talking the technology of mountain biking over the last, well, since I started, I mean, it's improved tenfold. I mean, it's, you know, even the most kind of basic stuff you can get now, like if you think about like Shimano Dior, like it's bomb-proof. It's absolutely bomb-proof. And I think the technology's improved a lot, but then the more technology you add, I guess, you know, the more things that can go wrong technically will go wrong. It's just, you know, it's just odds, really. But it depends on what kind of capacity, really. I mean, if it's loads of random parts bolted on that can just fly off as soon as you have a crash, then yes, but if it's well integrated and thought out and compact and is designed around being durable, then you wouldn't say it was any more or less likely to give you issues than anything else.
You've made me curious about motocross bikes with adjustable maps on them. The last motocross bike I rode was akin to an extremely disgruntled pony that wanted to get out from underneath me. So I need to look into those. Right, let's go to the people. I think we should revisit this and look at what tech stuff we might see emerging in the next few years in a bit more detail later on. But we did our normal. Basically, if this is your first Enduro World Series podcast, we put a wee shout out on our Instagram account, usually at the start of the week, basically ask us anything. Get your questions in next week and we will do our best to answer them. I've got a selection here from Thunt MTB is the first one. Are there public under 18 competitions and how do you enter? Rory, as sports coordinator, you can field that one.
So yeah, we've got the under 21 category at EWS, and that can be for, you know, EWS, EWS 100, EWS 80. So you can enter that the year of your 17th birthday, which off the top of my head would be anybody who's born 2004 or before. You can enter that. We are looking to try and have some EWS kids, so kind of kids events at races this year, and also we're working on an EWS 80 category of like 13 to 16 year olds as well. So yeah, there's definitely a way in if you're under 18, and not to mention that there's dozens of qualifier events and gold qualifier events that should have younger categories as well. So there's definitely a way of racing an EWS or an EWS affiliated race and getting on the pathway to racing the full EWS in the future.
Yeah, I'd say your best resource there is to head over to EnduroWorldSeries.com. You can find a complete list of all our races, all the affiliated races in our wee ecosystem. There's a breakdown of what all the different sort of monikers mean, and one of the things I've always said is the great thing about enduro is that it's racing the bikes that I think everyone has, and with, you know, especially EWS kids, with kids bikes getting so good now as well. I think the more racing, the better from all ages. Right, next up we have Tom GL, who says, what kind of fitness do you need to get into enduro racing? Now, this is kind of a difficult one, isn't it? Because it's kind of like any sport, and the follow-up question is, how well do you want to do?
Yeah, pretty much. I think, I mean, the biggest thing for enduro is you need a relatively good aerobic capacity. Even EWS 80 events can be 1500-1600 meter days. So it's about 1500-1600 meters of elevation that you climb. So, and you know, 5-6 hours on the bike. So you need a relatively good base aerobic fitness. And then other than that, I mean, we see quite a lot of variability even between the pro riders. You've got your your bigger, stronger riders like your Richie Roods who muscle the bike around, and then you've got your smaller, slighter guys, you know, Adrian Daly, or I mean, you look at Isabel, she's quite petite. So I think as long as you've got a good aerobic base and to manage the day, you can get around. And then besides that, I think it's working with what you have. If you like going to the gym and you're kind of bigger and stronger, then you can probably muscle the bike around a bit more. But if you're more slight, then you know, you can, and you've got good technique, then that's not going to hold you back either. So yeah, I mean, if you break it down and look at the pros, they're not really, they're strong everywhere. They're all strong physically. They're all really fit aerobically, and they've got a lot of power, and they're anaerobic, like their sprinting ability is really good as well. So yeah, can't really hide anywhere if you want to be at the top.
I think from an amateur point of view, as someone who's been out of puff on just about every Enduro World Series stage for the last 3.5 years or so, I would say that first of all, look at where you're going to be racing and what sort of style of stage that's going to have. If you look at where we go to in Chile, Lo Barnache, I mean, you've got a stage there that's 12 kilometres long, and I don't think anybody's getting the bottom of that fresh as a daisy. But I would say one of the great things about Enduro is that it's easily replicable. Do you know what I mean? Work out the sort of drop you think you're going to be racing across, and then build a local ride around it. Do you know what I mean? Work out 3 or 4 of your favourite trails and try and fit them all into a sort of 4 to 5 hour period, and work out where you're sort of feeling weakest, well, it's on the climbs or on the descents, and then base your training around that, I would say. Right. On to MTB Harry R. Who had the worst crash in 2020? Now, I'm not sure if Harry means between us or between the Enduro World Series pros. I'm going to selflessly nominate your crash in Petra Ligure on course preview. That was quite sizable.
That was soft. I didn't like that crash. It was a tip over, and there was just this enormous jaggy rock that I just launched my shin into.
Your one you had on that ride we didn't... The day after everything finished, we went for a big ride in Zermatt on the e-bikes, and we went up the top of, was it Oder Rothorn, and there was a really, really tight switchback and like a big scree slope, and I came around the switchback before it, and I just saw you sort of rolling slowly down the side of a mountain with nothing to stop you.
Yeah, there was an uphill kind of like 180 switchback, and we were trying to climb it on the e-bikes, and I tried to hop round, like you couldn't turn it was too tight, so I hopped and effectively hopped off the side of the trail, and then just Larry looped it and did a box leap, and I was rolling down the side of a Swiss Alp towards the Ibex.
You might call it a Swiss roll.
Very good.
I'll do the words, mate. I had just lots of small crashes everywhere. So, I mean, that's just general me riding bikes. In terms of EWS pros, there was some big ones. ALN had that big over the bars that lasted forever. In Zermatt, that was a horrible one. That was one of those ones where you've got loads of time to think about the crash you're about to have. Adrian Day went out the front door as well, didn't he, in Italy?
Yeah, Martin Mays in Pietro when the rains came in and made that Queen stage really, really slick. I was actually on the stage, and he came down with his helmet all busted up and his wrist kind of cut open and all kind of clattered and blood. And that was, I think I didn't see the actual crash, but I don't think you can have a minor tip over and end up doing that to yourself. So that must have been a big one.
That crash stopped Martin Mays, which, in my experience of covering Martin Mays' career, it takes an absolutely colossal impact for him to stop racing. Also, I think actually I was told after the race, the doctors told him he was extremely lucky. I think he was only a couple of millimetres away from a very, very big tube in that wrist. So never nice to see, but yeah, some big crashes as always. Next up, we have Paul Black 27.5. What is the cheapest good enduro bike in stock form? We have seen UK brand Calibre at the races in the last couple of years. I think they're affiliated with one of the major sort of outdoor retailers, and they've done what I always kind of wondered why not many more people did, in that they've just basically nailed the geometry of what is quite a cost-effective spec on a bike. Those look really good. I would also say that the second-hand market is full of absolutely superb bikes at the minute as well. We went through sort of a few years there where basically the only second-hand bikes had 26-inch wheels in them, but now that sort of generation of 27.5, 29-inch wheels are all in there as well. Also worth contacting your local bike shop and just asking them what they stock, if they know anybody who's got something good second hand. The good thing about
there's some kind of points to when it comes to if you're wanting like a bike that's good value for money, and a stock bike, certainly look towards the alloy, the aluminium or aluminum if you're in America option.
Nice.
I think carbon obviously can be visually, it can look a bit more attractive and a bit sleeker, but I think a lot of brands offer really, really good, really, really good options when it comes to the aluminium range. The geometry is the same; it might weigh a tiny bit more, which honestly isn't a bad thing. But if you get a good build kit on an aluminium frame, you can usually save yourself like a grand or sometimes even more. So. Yeah, certainly think about that kind of approach, and yeah, I think an alloy bike with good geometry and a decent set of components is better than a carbon bike with crap geometry and flimsy components. So
yeah, that's yeah, definitely a good point. I'd also say as well, it's worth going online or going to one of your local quality bike shop and sort of saying, right, I'm thinking about buying a secondhand bike, and then look at the stuff that you can do to make that on par or as close as you can to a new bike in terms of service and, you know, brakes bled, new pads, new rotors, new chain, maybe a suspension service, new tires. Weigh all that up and then budget that against the price of a secondhand bike versus, you know, a new bike stock. I always kind of think as well, you've got to look at, if you're going to go racing, you've got to look at the price of tyres as well and factor that in, because a set of good tyres now is comfortably over £100, which, although if you're going to spend £2 or £3 on a new bike, isn't that much in the bike scheme. It always kind of just feels like a bit of a kick in the stones that you're spending that extra money. So have a look at that, budget for that as well. And then finally, JPDMB says, how are new EWS race locations chosen? How do we get an EWS race in South Africa, for example? Rory?
We put a hold on Chris Ball and we have a globe and we spin it. He just blindfold on, just like puts his finger out and stops it and goes there. And that's how we decide.
There's that element of the spinning the globe and sticking your finger in it. There's also the actual way we do it, which is if you head over to EnduroWorldSeries.com, there is a tab up the top, interested in hosting an EWS, and that sort of gives you a bit of a guide for potential organisers about the different stuff we offer, how qualifiers work, and it's really sort of getting into that process and working with ourselves and then working your way up really to EWS status. It can take a couple of years, but it's part of the reason that I think that we continue to offer such a good mix of rounds and a good balance of organisers. You know, it's as much about balancing the local organisers with the areas they're in and the trails that they want to race on, you know, and making sure that we can offer the very best racing possible to racers. Right, I think that's us for this week, Rory. I'm going to go away and going to sort of draft up a big list of stuff that we need to talk about. But thank you for your time, as ever.
Yeah, no problem.
And if you are interested in entering an Enduro World Series, head over to EnduroWorldSeries.com. Stay in touch with our Instagram account, our Facebook account, and you can see just where and when races are going up, entries are going live. And hopefully we will see you at the races later in the summer. Thanks very much. Bye, Ruairi.
See you, mate.